This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey, Politicology, it's Ron Steslow, and I'm here today with the one and only Mike Madrid to answer your questions. We went into the mailbag and picked out some of the really good ones. And Anthony York is joining us as well. Anthony's currently California Governor Gavin Newsom's senior communications advisor. And before that, he covered California and national politics for more than two decades with the Los Angeles Times and Salon.com. Thanks, guys, for sticking around.
Yeah, good to be here.
All right, we're going to dive right in. Steven writes, I had hoped that the informal guardrails of democracy would be strengthened after a Biden presidency or by a Biden presidency. After the shattering of norms of the Trump administration, why haven't Biden and the Dems attempted to codify some of those norms to restore normalcy, such as personal tax transparency, requiring subpoena compliance, and other democratic norms? It is important to me, and other Democrats said it was important. So why do you think nothing has been done?
Yeah, look, I'll jump into this. And look, I've said this for a while. I mean, whether they do or whether they don't, I think that what we're really forging is the character of our nation. When we're being tried by these very challenging moments, and we've been through much tougher, by the way, as a country than the times that we're seeing right now. When we talk about norms, when you codify norms, they become laws. And I'm not suggesting that we don't do that, but there are not enough norms that you can codify to protect a republic or protect a democracy if the people don't want it. That's the lesson of this era. That's the lesson of this moment, is we need to make it impalatable and drive the scourge from within our midst. I think that right now we are in an existential moment where the good guys are going to win or the bad guys are going to win. And if the good guys win, then I think that we can continue on with this American experiment for another three or four generations. That's how foundational this is. You can't codify that. You can't write a constitution with all the safeguards and guardrails you need to protect a democracy if enough people in that country, in that society, in that nation do not want it. So, Stephen, I get it. I hear you. I would like to see some of those. But until it becomes unacceptable socially to allow what has happened, and we've got to remember a lot of this stuff is being not only accepted, it's being encouraged, it's being promoted, it's being amplified. Until we drive that out and defeat that, there's nothing that you can do to protect our society. That's what democracy is. We are democracy. We are all a part of it. And that's, I think, the best way to ensure the success of the republic.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Anthony, I wonder what you think about this, because the thing I think of is, everything Mike said is right. And also, it's true that we seem to have really shallow understandings of what it means to participate in democracy now. We seem to have very thin, flimsy relationships with the concept of physics, civics now, yep. Which we don't.
Both,
actually.
We don't really teach any, and physics for that matter. But, yeah. But I think Mike is right. And yet it seems we don't actually have the equipment. We don't have the tools, the pedagogical tools in place to make sure that that students and adults have the knowledge they need in order to participate in what makes democracy work, what makes our republic work in the first place. I think there's a vast vacuum of understanding, and so that leaves us vulnerable to whims and manipulation by I think social media especially. But what do you think?
Yeah, totally agree. And look, the rise of our nation and the nation states generally, right, they sort of overlapped. It was sort of a product of the industrial age, right? The Industrial Revolution gave birth to these nation states. And now that we're in this post-industrial era, right, the sort of information era, it's changing everything, including the notion of citizenship and how citizens participate. And I think there are real questions. I mean, look, our institutions have these older institutions have been coming increasingly under assault over the last few years. in ways I've never seen in my lifetime. And jury's still out, but those institutions are going to have to evolve and change as well. And so, to Stephen's point, it's like, why hasn't that change happened yet? You know, it's also, we're in the middle of the fight, but we do have to be thinking about how we fortify and adapt these institutions so they can survive this transformation.
Mike's nodding his head. Yeah. Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
No, and it's the old Justice Brandeis stuff, right? That the most important office in a democracy is that of citizen, right? And it's easier. Look, I mean, I see it in my own, like, whether it's service clubs like Rotary and, you know, like Kiwanis Club organized religion. I think that participation in these sort of civic institutions has diminished, right? And we've become highly more individualized, right? I mean, because we all have the world at our fingertips and the interphone. I mean, individualism, rugged individualism is also part of our founding narrative as well. And it's some way, there's a built-in paradox there in sort of the American identity between the rugged individual and the sort of civically engaged citizen. That's up for grabs right now, and that's incumbent upon all of us to not only fortify the old institutions, but look for new ones that we can build to help strengthen our civic society.
Yeah, renewing and refreshing those institutions so that they work as easy as and are accessible as social media, which has us all addicted. I mean, that's the real project, I think.
Absolutely.
Number two, Sean writes, do you think the rise of social media has allowed the crazies to find each other and finally have a voice? That crazy uncle who no one agreed with can now find other like-minded people and feel empowered. Is the genie out of the bottle? I think the answer is a resounding and obvious yes, but I'll put it to you. Put it to you, Mike.
Yeah, but it's also allowed good people to gather too, right? And listening intently to what Anthony was saying about this, the mythology of rugged individualism, but also the declining lack of a commitment to one another. You have to have both, or America doesn't work, right? That is our uniqueness. And I think that social media has allowed us to create community beyond geographic space. It has allowed the crazies to find one another and create their own communities, which is, I think, in many ways amplified their voices. But it's also allowed people of good conscience to organize together. And again, earlier, you know, in a previous segment and discussions I've had with both of you, we have to remember just how many times Democrats have won the popular vote. There are more Democrats. There are more people who agree with a more positive, optimistic, aspirational, traditional view of American democracy than not. And that number is growing. It's not getting smaller. And as long as it organizes, it will succeed. But more importantly, and this is, I think, really important, as the nation state declines in relevance during the digital age, people are going to have to start building coalitions transnationally. And that's the future of social and political movements, is political parties will become transnational. They will work and coordinate and succeed beyond state lines, beyond the lines and barriers of country, as we start to move into a world that is going to be those that support small d democracy efforts, democratic efforts, and those that are more compelled by authoritarianism. And that's going to be the struggle. That's going to be the fight. There are going to be people like here in the United States helping out the Ukrainians and helping out the dissidents in China and helping out people in, you know, Iran that want to see freedom. And conversely, there are authoritarian fascist elements in American society that are working with the Russians to kind of move the world in that direction. That is the future. It's not going to be Republicans and Democrats. Don't mean to offend anybody or hurt anybody's sensibilities if you're that drunk on the partisan Kool-Aid on whatever side you're on, but that's not that alone is not going to be able to protect democracy in this century. As a citizen, we are going to have to be more globalized and values based and work beyond just, you know, and I'm not, this isn't a criticism of going to the Kiwanis Club. We need to do that. We need to take care of that local community geographically, but we also have to be part of these increasingly global efforts that are helping the people in Ukraine, that are helping people fight off authoritarian regimes in Mexico, for God's sakes, and anywhere where that threat exists to democratic, small d democratic efforts becomes more important to us here as we preserve and protect our own democracy.
Yeah, as the world that we spend so much time in is increasingly, as we said earlier, borderless and digital and diffused, those communities don't, the communities you're talking about can be very geographically diverse and yet united by the same values that the Ukrainians are fighting for. For example, go ahead, Anthony. I think you were.
Oh, I was just smiling to myself hearing Mike Madrid paraphrasing Karl Marx. You know, that was. I just got a kick out of that one. But I mean,
the listeners here won't be surprised by that. By the way,
but, no, they won't.
Yeah, but it is true. And I think back to the original question. I mean, look, yes, these were the social media was the tool that brought us the Arab Spring and. You know, can be a democratizing tool, but increasingly, I think now that these tools, it's like you see how quickly that pivots and can be a powerful tool for authoritarianism as well. And you know, deep concerns. I mean, we were talking earlier about who controls these new tools and how quickly they become de-democratized because of the consolidated ownership or the state interested ownership or the, you know, people who use these tools to advance non-democratic agendas. And so, yeah, it's again, something we're going to have to continue to wrestle with and address.
Yeah. I think it is important to think of them as tools that are morally and value in terms of values neutral. It depends on how they're used and in whose hands they fall. Karen asks, why do the chattering classes assume that when people tell pollsters that the country is headed in the wrong direction, it means they disapprove of the president's performance? If I were asked that question on a poll, I might say wrong direction because of the actions and attitudes of the MAGA crowd and the Republican officials around the country who pander to them. But I approve of President Biden's performance. If he has not succeeded in turning the country around, I do not blame him. Rather, I give him a great deal of credit for what he has accomplished and the grace, dignity, and compassion with which he has accomplished it. So, if most Democrats agree with me and most Republicans think the Democrats are leading the country in the wrong direction, we'd get a very high percentage of wrong direction answers that mean exactly nothing about how people will vote. Mike?
Yeah, look, that's exactly right. But it doesn't mean that the finding is meaningless. It means what I've counseled on polling a lot over the years, which is unless you're developing the poll yourself, the findings are always going to be suspect. But let's also not delude ourselves into believing that Joe Biden is an overwhelmingly popular president. He is not, and he never has been. And a lot of that weakness comes from core Democratic constituencies, especially young people and people of color, and increasingly the working class, which is leaving the Democratic Party. That's just factual. That's just where it is. Now, that when in a campaign construct, it's always better to be, you know, have your opponent be more disliked than you, which is really what defines American politics. Is you don't have to be popular if your opposition is, you know, more unpopular than you are, right? It's the old adage about not having, you know, the two hikers in the woods come upon a bear. You don't have to outrun the bear. You just have to outrun the partner that you're with, right? That's a campaign in a nutshell. And that's really what has defined most of our presidential contests since at least the year 2000, probably longer. Don't read too much into polls, except for looking at kind of the poll of polls, the cumulative stuff, and look for just the foundational numbers. If you're trying to discern something from one poll, you're really doing yourself a disservice. It's just going to drive you crazy. That's not what you're going to get out of it unless you designed the poll yourself and know exactly what you're looking for. It's a criticism I've had of public polls for a long time. Again, I'm probably a little bit closer to this than most people that are observing these things are. So, of course, I'm going to be a little bit more finicky about it. But the point is taken. It is largely accurate, but that doesn't necessarily lead to the conclusion that she's talking about.
Yeah. Anthony, do you want to speak a little bit to the difference between, for example, why Biden would be unpopular? I think Mike mentioned two different groups, young people and also working class voters. That doesn't mean they dislike him for the same reasons, right?
Correct. And I think, look, there are also two distinct questions, right? Right track, wrong track about the country, I think speaks to Karen's initial question, right? There could be a lot of reasons for right track, wrong track. And then there's a separate question about personal popularity, personal approval ratings for the president. In this case, I think we have both, you know, both numbers are sub 50%. And I think to the first question, I think it does speak to a larger atmospheric, right? More than concerns about right track, wrong track being a referendum on any individual office holder, I think it's an important sort of diagnostic tool about the climate that we're in, right? And there was a hope that Biden would be sort of an interrupter, a sort of a break that would allow this fever to break. And what's clear, I think, coming out of this is that the anxiety that existed pre-Biden still exists. And that's on both sides, right? That we haven't, this fever hasn't broken. This fight isn't over. This is not going to stop. You know, it's going to take a couple of more cycles for this to play out. And so I think that's what the right track, wrong track represents. And I expect it to be sub 50% for a while. And we saw that was impervious to economics. Even when the economy was strong, you had a lot of, you had wrong track. And that's, I think that speaks to which issues are top of mind and the kinds of concerns and deep, deep anxieties that a lot of Americans feel about what's happening in our country.
Next up is Bruce. Here's a bit of a curveball, Mike. Bruce asks, has anyone ever calculated what the Electoral College results of past elections would be if all states had rules like New Hampshire and Nebraska? Does voting data allow that kind of assessment? And just to be clear, he's talking about the policy where whoever wins the most votes in the state gets two electoral votes and the rest are awarded based on who gets the most votes in each congressional district's proportionality. So for our listeners, that's what Bruce is talking about. Mike?
Yeah, you could technically do it. The challenge, I think, becomes one of looking back at some of the previous redistricting efforts and making some assumptions about how and why they were districted the way that they were. So the short answer, Bruce, is yes, you could do it. No, I haven't seen it because I'm as much as I'm a political data nerd, I'm not that much of a nerd. History happened. I'm not too worried about what could have been or should have been or what that means. I just don't know. But God bless you, Bruce. If you do find it, we will actually post it here on a link somewhere because I want to see what that looks like.
Well, actually, our producer did a quick check using House voting in 2020. He wasn't going to be able to do the actual presidential. Vote by House district, using this method, Joe Biden would have still won in 2020, but it would have been 275 to 263 instead of 306 to 232. Mm. So,
okay,
there you go.
So, yeah, I think if you look at the 2000 race, right, some of these really close contests, you're going to see some of that, right? And we're going to see these larger variations as urban cores become more intensely blue with huge numbers and rural red America becomes more red with lesser, sparser counties. Those variations are going to pop up and be more commonplace than we've seen over the past few decades. But again, none of those changes are afoot. And you can, I'm not saying don't look at it. There's hobbyists that want to do all this stuff all the time, but if the goal is to delegitimize somebody on one way or the other, probably more constructive ways to spend your time. Yeah,
could be a search for a different kind of system, right? National system,
yeah.
Right?
So. Yeah. I think there's some general and widely shared frustration with, you know, the calcification of the current system not being super responsive. But
it sounds like sounds like the numbers from the last analysis would actually potentially make the problem worse. Having not gone back, but given the way that our nation is gerrymandered.
Let me, for the record here, and again, this is not going to make me popular on politicology, but I'm okay with that. I'm a very, very big fan of the Electoral College, as I'm a very big fan of having United States Senate. They were created for the same reasons. You want to get rid of Electoral College? Get rid of the Senate, because that prevents civil war. that's why it's there. And I know a lot of people are saying, well, let's go to war with whatever. I don't believe that. I guess like Lincoln, I believe that union is important.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. And it is again, I think it speaks to the vacuum of civics education, the outrage that happens when you talk about the Electoral College being an actual good thing.
But it is interesting. Look, it's going to become under more, it's going to be tested more. Yeah. It happened once in our history, right? Until before 2000. And since 2000, it's happened three times, right? So, I mean, it's going to put more stress on that institution as well.
Yep. So fortify it. Okay. Before the midterms, this is a question reaching a little bit back, but it's a good one. So, Anthony, to you, Christy asked us, this year, we've heard over and over again that the Democrats are terrible with messaging and aren't spreading the information about what Biden has accomplished since he's been in office. My question is, has anyone told them? Would it be effective for a moderate pro-Dem and not necessarily anti-Republican or anti-Trump to launch these types of information campaigns?
Yeah, look, we've tried. I mean, I think that certainly the right and the sort of the Fox News and the echo chamber on the right is more advanced than whatever we have on the left. But I think there's also a case that like the Biden's accomplishments have largely been economic victories, whether you look at, the IRA or, Build Back Better and the things that were portions of that he was able to accomplish. There have been large economic victories, but I don't think that's where our politics are right now. And so I always bristle a bit when people tell us all we have is a communications problem. You have to look at the issues as well. And look, we're seeing, I think, a national break on issues. I think the abortion issue has been, it's been a gut punch for the Republican Party, and yet they still seem to be pushing it in a lot of these states. I guess it's good primary politics. I don't know. There are people on the right, I'm sure, smarter than I, that understand why this makes sense for them. But from where I sit, it doesn't make any sense. But I'm sensitive to that critique. But I also, anyone who tells me it's only a communications problem, I look at a bit skeptically.
I'm going to just read the second question, Mike, and then we'll get into it because they're related. But I think that that critique for many people, they kind of wear it as a security blanket to think, well, if only we could talk better about the real stuff, as opposed to looking at the issues, looking at the real stuff. I think that's a bit of a blind spot. Karen asks something similar along the same lines. I often hear you and your guests lament that Democrats aren't communicating this or that effectively. Usually this or that is something that I am extremely aware of, and usually it's not something I just heard of by listening to Politicology, but something that's been prominently covered in the major newspapers that I read. I guess the communication problem you were talking about involves grabbing the attention of people who aren't otherwise exposed to the information. But how is that done these days? How do you get people to hear something when they don't want to listen? So Mike, similar question to you. We've talked a lot about reaching persuadable voters, but how do you think about the varying degrees of people who don't want to listen to people who've been exposed to information when you're making decisions about the types of voters you want to target with particular messages, and also just, our general drift into silos, information silos and bubbles now that we are, we don't put a lot of effort into getting out of them. Many people don't put a lot of effort into getting out of their information bubbles. So.
Well, let me talk about it from a campaign construct, because that's all I really know. No one, fortunately, has ever hired me to be involved in the governance process. That's where you hire people like Anthony, who are a little bit more.
Not true. I remember Rod Pacheco. Never forget.
6 months. I went for 6 months for the state. That was when I was 26 years old.
Wow.
It's going to become increasingly important to speak to those silos, because that's the only way you can get elected. So again, let me bring it back to the Lincoln Project. We were talking about cultural issues because we knew that that would move just enough voters from the Republican coalition to Joe Biden to win the race. That happens to be about 7 to 9% of the Republican electorate. So you had all these Beltway pundits saying the Lincoln Project's messaging, this doesn't even work. It's making Republicans angry. And they're right. For 90% of Republicans, it was not working. But for the 10% that we needed, it was working magnificently enough to get Joe Biden elected president. So that's the way this works. And if you're watching this and you're not feeling that resonance, the messaging is probably not focused to you. It's not for you because either you aren't persuadable on this or you have already been persuaded, so nobody is trying to connect with you. And unfortunately, these silos are very, very small. They're on the margins because, again, as I've said more times than I care to reiterate, there are no undecideds in American politics anymore. The lane of people that are genuinely listening and going, how do I feel about Build Back Better, is so small. It's so small, it's really inconsequential. Mm-hmm. And that, is to Anthony's point, isn't even where the battlefield is at. And look, do I think Democrats have a messaging problem? I would say that they've got a problem with choosing the battlefield upon which to fight. When they're responding to Glenn Youngkin on critical race theory in a governor's race, yeah, you're going to get your ass kicked. And you should if your people are that incompetent. If you're choosing the battlefield, if you're dictating the terms of engagement, which is really the trick of a political campaign, then no, they don't have a messaging problem. If you're talking about the issues with the right voters about what you want to talk about, that's how you win campaigns. And Democrats are capable of it. I think most people that are frustrated by this are like, why isn't Biden more popular? Why don't people look at what we're doing for the economy? And the truth of the matter is the vast majority of the public doesn't buy that Build Back Better is a good solution to paying the rent next Friday, because you know what? It's not.
Anthony, any of the closing thoughts? I think these are great questions.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think they speak to sort of these modern challenges, right? The fracturing of not only our politics, but our communications as well. And these are, again, I come at this from the perspective of on the communication side. These are huge, huge challenges. And you know, Mike talked about the battlefield singular. I mean, I think it's no longer the battlefield. It's the battlefields plural.
Right.
And it's a prism, right, that has divided this into dozens and dozens of different micro battlefields. And that is the hard work that you have to engage on all these to make the calculation to move just enough persuadable people in all these little places and all these little ways. And it makes our jobs infinitely more interesting, but a hell of a lot harder as well.
All right, gang, let's leave it there for today. Thank you to everybody who wrote in, even though we didn't get to your question today. We're going to do more of these episodes, so keep them coming. We love to hear from you, and I'm always impressed by the questions we get from Politicology listeners. It is no surprise to me that Karen already knew about the things that we were talking about, because Politicology listeners tend to be very, very well informed. So keep them coming, and we'll talk to you again soon.